It's Wednesday. It's May the 20th. It's 2:37 in the afternoon. Hello, everyone. It's John Hanson of the Mincing Rascals. I try and come on when I can. Gonna host today for John Williams, who's on a well-deserved vacation, a cruise with some WGN radio listeners. And I hope some Mincing Rascal listeners, too. I'm sure there are. Joined by the esteemed panel, as always, today, Eric Zorn, former Chicago Tribune columnist, publisher of the Picayune Sentinel on Substack, Marge Halpern, the award-winning journalist and communications consultant turned pundit and community activist, and Chicago journalist Kate Blies, publisher of Roseland, Chicago, 1972. Guys, it's so good to see you all. How are you all doing?
Okay.
You're more than welcome to complain if you want.
Hanging in there. Yeah,
you're hanging in there. Okay. We got the weekend coming up, a long weekend. Hopefully everyone's going to find some time to relax and get into the summer vibes. Hopefully by the end of the week or soon, we're going to get an answer on this Bears stadium. In my mind, I don't want to hear another word about this story until I have an answer from the Bears one way or the other. Is there more palace intrigue? I don't care about it anymore. I just want to know where the Bears are going. But through that story, we have seen an interesting new layer to the relationship between Mayor Brandon Johnson and Governor Pritzker. Governor Pritzker quite vividly explaining why he thinks Brandon Johnson is not good at politics. Essentially, he didn't quite say it like that, but essentially said that Mayor Brandon Johnson only shows up in May for his complaints or ideas on what the state budget should hold, and he doesn't understand the political process. Mayor Johnson later went on WVON and tried to tout that he's not a billionaire like Governor Pritzker. I don't know exactly where that is in the full conversation, and in full disclosure, I didn't listen to the whole thing. I'm not asking everyone to pick sides, but I kind of am in this case. These two shouldn't be fighting. I'd love if they worked together. That'd be best for the state and for the city to solve things together. It seems like they just keep on having breaks in their relationship. So, I don't know. Eric, let's talk about it. Who are you going with? Which side? Who are you picking?
Well, I think that J.B. Pritzker is much better at politics than Brandon Johnson is, and I think that Pritzker has some good points to make about Mayor Johnson's failure to create relationships down in Springfield and to make his case with the General Assembly, that Pritzker is correct, that Johnson shows up late, and he thinks that if he can just badger people into what he considers to be a fair tax system, that he's going to get it done. And I think that his manner, his approach has been off-putting to the General Assembly. So Pritzker is correct in that Mayor Johnson's bad at politics. On the other hand, I don't really see the advantage to Pritzker of going out and calling out Johnson in public like that. And I'm not sure whether this was a planned, scripted thing for the governor or whether this was something that just kind of came up and he unburdened himself at a news conference. But it isn't a good look, because Chicago is the engine of Illinois. And I think it's very important for the governor of the state and the mayor of Chicago to have a good relationship, because the well-being of Illinois kind of depends on it. And so I was a little surprised, a little disappointed by it, even though I think I'm on Team Pritzker here.
Marge, they're both from the same party, of course, that we know, but they're also, it's not like Pritzker is some centrist blue dog Democrat. He's a progressive, just like Mayor Johnson. You ask them how they feel about certain things, they probably align 9 times out of 10 on their belief system. Mm-hmm. What's going on here?
Well, I think the issue is they do have two different focuses. Foci. Their jobs are different, because it's Johnson's job to keep the Bears in Chicago. Now, he didn't do a very good job of that, because the only proposal on the table is the one that he fell head over heels for before he showed it to anyone else. And then once the public saw it, they didn't like it. It's not really workable. It's incredibly expensive. It's a big handout of taxpayer dollars to the Bears, and no one in the state who pays taxes wants to do that. So he failed to put forth a really strong proposal for the Bears, but he's demanding that they stay in Chicago, and he thinks that's Pritzker's job. Pritzker's job is to keep them in Illinois. And there is a pretty decent proposal for Arlington Heights that would keep the Bears in the state. Pritzker will have done his job well, but Johnson will not. And that's where I think the tension comes.
Does it worry you, Marge, that this is their relationship and that things are falling through the cracks that could benefit the state in Chicago that aren't getting done because Pritzker says that Mayor Johnson isn't showing up when he needs to?
You know, Democrats don't benefit from infighting. No party benefits from infighting. we benefit when Republicans are infighting, and vice versa. Why would we stop and fight with ourselves when, in fact, our state and city are being attacked by the federal government, taking away money for services, making our budget at both city and state levels even tighter than it was before, which was bad already. So there's a lot of things they ought to be working together on, and some that they are, of course, but that's where this becomes a distraction. We could play the attraction-distraction game, and I would shove this into that category.
Kate, do you think that this was a planned thing that he did off the cuff? Why is J.B. Pritzker going out and airing the dirty laundry?
Well, I think you may have hit on it a little while ago, John, when you were pointing out that Pritzker does not position himself as even a centrist, much less a conservative Democrat. He positions himself as a progressive. He's very proud of being a progressive. But Mayor Johnson is even prouder of being even more progressive, right? So it kind of, a lot of the times with the progressive movement, it's kind of the narcissism of small differences where you almost hate the people who are most like you because they're not absolutely 100% exact like you. And it's a continual problem, I think, with the progressive movement in general, and certainly here in Chicago, that anybody who disagrees with them, even 1%, is not just incorrect, but immoral. You know, just so, so wrong and a bad person. And unfortunately, Mayor Johnson takes this tack also with Governor Pritzker, and he doesn't miss any chances to kind of get a dig in there. There was, you know how he did a whole spate of interviews last week for his upcoming third anniversary in office. And in one of them, and I'm sorry, I could not find the exact quote, but in one of them, I heard him specifically kind of jabbing Pritzker about not being as progressive as he was. I just thought, why are you doing that? What do you hope to get out of that when you yourself are this week in Springfield trying to get favors? And I don't know if Governor Pritzker specifically heard that one or another one, another jab, and he just couldn't help himself. I do think he does tend to think about what he's going to say. So I think he probably did it on purpose in his press conference.
Well, he also wants to give the Pope a Cubs hat for no reason. From Block Club Chicago. That was Quinn Myers reporting on that.
I think Pritzker is trying to thread this incredibly narrow path as obviously both a gubernatorial and a future presidential candidate.
Yes.
He's wants to position himself as progressive, but he also needs to distance himself from the very most unpopular politician in the state who's veered off into the unpopular progressive territory.
Yeah.
So I think that's what he's doing.
I think so too, Kate. I also think he's already staking out a position in the mayoral election. I don't think if he's going to wade into it directly. But Eric, I think he's happy to let Chicagoans know, I don't like your mayor and I want someone else.
No, I think that's exactly right. I think he believes that he's going to have a better companion on the fifth floor of City Hall at the end of Mayor Johnson's term. I think he does not want Mayor Johnson reelected for that reason. I'm not sure who he's backing or if he's even got someone directly in mind. It could be Alexi Janulius. It could be Congressman Quigley. It could be Susana Mendoza. I don't know of all the people who he's got in mind. Maybe he's Alderman Riley. Who knows who he's got in mind? But I think he believes that he can work better with someone who is a little less strident than Mayor Johnson has been. Kate talked about this narcissism of small differences. Oh, another story in the news that comes to mind is this tiff between Michael Sacks, the billionaire, and Stacey Davis Gates, the president of the Chicago Teachers Union, who've been in an epistolary feud this past week where Stacey Davis Gates, you know, called out Sacks for not appropriately. She wanted him to stop funding candidates in the upcoming school board race, and he fired back with a very sharp letter. And these are both people who are, you know, pretty far on the left, and they are really going at it. And I kind of hate to see these people fighting at a time when this country's in trouble, and we're going to get to some of those topics later. But there's a lot of really major, serious, scary issues out there. And the left is forming this like circular firing squad over some of these issues.
Well, I was just going to say it's just a local example of the rift in the Democratic Party, which is just going to become more and more evident the closer we get to the presidential.
Marge, any thoughts on last thoughts on this one?
Kate kind of hit this point about Pritzker taking the opportunity to define where he stands and a little distance from Johnson for a presidential race will help the governor, I think. And Johnson probably the same. If he's really staking the far left spot, he's taken every chance to do so. Those interviews that you mentioned, Kate, his 3-year interviews, were kind of appalling in the way that his statements are always appalling. He's high on rhetoric and low on strategy and policy. He just missed the polls. I don't care about the polls. I'm here working for the people of Chicago. Well, the polls tell you the people of Chicago don't think you are. So you should pay a little attention. I don't know. It's just it's frustrating to hear his imperviousness to the criticism.
Well, it all played out in front of us, and I don't know where this quote-unquote feud ends, except if neither one of them have one of their jobs coming forward, because I think this is pretty ingrained in what they're doing, not to the benefit, I think, of any Illinoisans or Chicagoans. Pete Crow Armstrong, we're coming off the Crosstown Classic, the White Sox beating the Cubs 2 out of 3 games and then sending the Cubs on a continual downward spiral. Pete Crow Armstrong, the center fielder for the Chicago Cubs, missed a ball. Not that hard of a play. I thought he was going to get it in right center field. A fan who was essentially at field level on the south side in this grouping of seats that's just separated by a chain link fence, but they stand eye to eye to each other, basically. A White Sox fan who admitted that she couldn't wait to heckle Pete Crow Armstrong and was thinking of things and digs and burns all day long leading up to the game, took her opportunity to really criticize his play on that particular play. Pete Crow Armstrong fired back. And he didn't do so in a funny way or in a baseball-minded way. He said something really derogatory. I don't think he's a sexist. I actually don't know. But he said something that I would determine to be fairly sexist. He said, and I won't say it, but you can Google it, but basically and went on from there. And then used derogatory terms towards women. I was then appalled that he didn't apologize at the end of the game for his words. Only when the true words came out and there was the media circus, including us talking about it, did he say that he regrets his words. I want to start with just the baseline of should fans, we're going to get to PCA in a bit, do fans have the right to basically they bought a ticket and heckle baseball players in any way they want to? I say, yes, you bought that ticket. You can do what you want. I'm just going to go to Eric first, only because I know he disagrees with me on this one, so I want his side.
Yeah, I want security to throw people out who are using vulgar language to attack the players. Armstrong told the Sun-Times that he had been on the on-deck circle 5 straight at-bats, and they were calling his mother a whore.
Well, that's no good.
Well, that's no good, so I don't think anyone who buys a ticket has a right to do that. I think they should preserve a little bit of decorum. Booing is okay, razzing them when they're that, but using vulgar language. And this woman who camped out, and she bought those tickets so she could say something awful to Pete Crow Armstrong, and that catch would have been pretty great if he'd made it.
True.
By the way, I mean it wasn't like he'd dropped a
it was
can of
easy
corn.
For him, not easy for him. It's he makes those plays routinely, and he makes them look easy.
And she says you suck. Well, the thing is that Pete Crow Armstrong, I'm not a Cub fan, I'm a White Sox fan, but Pete Crow Armstrong does not suck. He's a Gold Glove winning MLB All-Star.
Okay. I don't like the mother talk. That's not okay. Personal attacks are. I guess what I'm saying is she has the right as a fan to say you suck. That's like such a common sports thing. Hey, you suck. There's nothing wrong with saying you suck. I cannot believe that triggered BCA.
Yeah, well, I think it was, he claims he popped after this other abuse about his mother, and he finally went over the edge. He apologized for his words. I don't think he apologized directly to the fan. They fined him $5,000. I did a calculation on that $5,000 fine, by the way, which he makes somewhere around, he's going to be making somewhere around $20 million a year. So that's the equivalent of someone who makes $100,000 a year getting a $25 parking ticket. I think he's going to be okay.
Yeah. Well, okay. Then to the words that he said back, I mean, I don't know, a $5,000 fine, no game suspension, kind of gets the green light to continue to do what he's, you know, I don't know. How does that make either of you guys feel?
Let me just add, he does need to get thicker skin. And this is something that ball players have to realize. They're getting paid $20 million a year in some cases to play a game. And people are going to say stuff. And Eric Zorn's rule about fan behavior is not going to be implemented. We're going to be under the Hansen regime. but he does have to get a thicker skin. And $5,000, he finds that in the couch cushions and hands it over.
Kate?
Talk about needing to grow a thicker skin. Yeah, I mean, come on. This guy is a big baby. And I'm not a Cub fan, but my husband is. And he right away told me, oh, this guy, he's just always throwing his helmet around, throwing bats around. He really needs to learn how to control himself. So this is him to begin with. But I have to disagree with you a bit here, Eric. I don't think that fans' abuse necessarily cannot contain profanity. They should not be calling out people's mothers on anything. I agree with you, John, on that. But profanity, come on, it's a ball game. It's going to be there.
And I don't mind that PCA swore. It's the graphic language that he used that mattered. Yeah.
I mean, it's okay with me if the fans get a little rough too. They shouldn't be too over the top. I agree. If they are truly being abusive, then maybe security could do something about that. I would agree with you there. But "you suck" is literally the most baseline possible insult to yell at a ball player. You're a Sox fan now. I don't know if you've actually ever gone to any Sox games, though. Okay. But pretty much you can normally go to Comiskey, and I still call it that, and sit where you want to most of the time. And I have spent many a game sitting right near first base. And the stuff that I have heard yelled by some people I know sitting near me at first baseman has been horrific.
It's you just saying it. Just admit you yell, "you suck" to players.
I don't follow it closely enough to bother. But I can remember a few games with like Jose Canseco, when I really thought surely what was being said to him, not just by my friends, but other people, would get him to climb up the wall and kill somebody.
And he could.
But he just smiled and walked off because he was Jose Canseco. And this guy is PCA. He should absolutely be above a little "you suck" with two thumbs down. And what he came back with, I think we have to be clear, although I'm fine with him just getting the $5,000 fine and being publicly shamed about this for a while. I am okay with that. But what he said was not just profane. It really went into incredibly vile territory that if I said the entire phrase out loud to you, Marge, and I know you weren't following this story, so you don't know exactly what he said, but what he said immediately went beyond profanity into sexualization in really kind of a almost threatening phrase. And I am completely free speech, and speech is not violence. I am not saying that he committed violence with his phrase, but it was an incredibly misogynistic thing to say.
Yes, unfortunately,
so
we can't.
Deserved a moment of shame because it was way beyond just saying, you know, "f you" in response.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit about that. These expressions that he used, and I'm sorry we can't actually use them here on this family podcast, but they are not to be taken literally, just like "FU" is not taken literally. These are just expressions that people use when they're angry.
But not to a woman. He knew it was
not
a woman.
Not the phrase he said. He said is not a commonly used
phrase. Well, hold on. In my younger days, if I were to spout that to a buddy of mine who was being a jerk, I shouldn't have said something like that. But I could see myself saying that to another guy in like kind of a off the cuff way. Boy, I'm veering too close to locker room talk. But I shouldn't have, and no one should say that in general. But he knew he was looking at a woman, and he said that. And I think that does make a difference. I mean, it shouldn't, but it does. And Marge, I want to give you a chance to weigh in.
One of the first things you said introducing the topic, John, was that you didn't think he was a sexist, though you don't really know. I'm going to say a man who is not a sexist won't use those words. Think about it. Reminded me of Michael Richards, you know, on Seinfeld, who plays Kramer on Seinfeld, and he had that horrible profanity, ugly, racist tirade, and then said later, "But I'm not a racist." Those are words. I'm not a racist. Those words can't come out of my mouth even when I don't have to think and screen myself. Those are just not words that occur to me. And I think men who are comfortable with women and have a good relationship with women and don't see them as inferior or a threat or any of those negative things, don't use words like he did. The fact that when pushed to the brink, he went to words that I see your struggle, Kate, sexually harass a woman, maybe is the most you could say, but with that inference because she's a woman, is sexist, and it comes from somewhere in his soul that tells me he's not entirely, you can't say he's not a sexist.
Exactly. Well,
it's like people that have an outburst with the N-word. That comes from somewhere. And it doesn't come from somebody who feels egalitarian and comfortable with other races.
Like, it's his instant response to say something that incredibly misogynistic to somebody instead of just, if he said that, nobody would care. It would be like,
Eric, last thought?
Well, my last thought is, someone who is perhaps more familiar with locker room talk and locker room insults, I can imagine him saying almost the exact same words to a man. And if anyone wants to see the exact expression, it will be in tomorrow's Picayune Sentinel.
So okay.
No asterisks involved.
It's not a family publication.
Marge, I agree with you on a lot of points. I guess why I said I teed it up by saying that he's not a sexist, because I guess I could still allow room for someone saying, and I get your point, though. When Tom Brenneman on an off mic, or he thought he was off the mic, said the derogatory F words about homosexuals, he said it's so hard and so forceful that I was like, he's definitely used these words before. So it'd be hypocritical for me not to at least maybe hold that assumption to be true with PCA. I guess I'm just covering all my bases, no pun intended. And also, I do think, even in horrific things that people say, whether you're against the Sox fan or the Cubs fan, I do think no one's entire life should be judged by the totality of 10 seconds. And I hope I think a lot of people are of a, hey, if there's some genuine remorse and some growth that comes out of it, so be it. And that's okay with me.
Can I throw in one more quick point that Kate almost made, but I'll accentuate it. So this woman spent all day thinking of insults, and "you suck" is the best she could come up with.
That's good. One of the big topics always these days is we need more housing. We absolutely need more housing. Housing costs are out of control. Average 30-year fixed mortgage rate, last time I checked, was 6.7%. That's if you have enough to have a down payment to even buy a house to even enter that conversation. Rents are a real problem in the city and have been for a long time, and extend to the suburbs as well. So the fact that the state legislature is talking about this and trying to figure out ways, and by the way, this is a very bipartisan issue, by the way, both parties agree that more housing is needed. It's something even the president has weighed in, and not that we have tangible solutions in Congress yet, but there's been conversations for both parties. And I think that's a good thing about the cost of affordable housing and housing in general. Except when it's next to your house and you don't want a 4-flat or a 5-flat or beyond. Marge, walk us through a little bit of this story and where the rubber meets the road with this Build Illinois.
So Build Illinois is actually a package of bills. They're bundled into an omnibus bill for the House, but there are 6 separate bills, and they're all separate in the Senate, being debated separately. And they do things like, there's a single stair reform. You may know that if you have a building in Chicago that's more than 2 stories, you have to have 2 fire stair exits. That's why you see a lot of those metal fire escapes on the outside of buildings. So this would eliminate that for up to 6 stories, which is consistent with, I believe, New York and a lot of other cities, but it would be a change in our fire code here and elsewhere around the state. They delete or override impact fees that are used by various municipalities to discourage certain kinds of housing, whether it's overbuilding or teardowns. They're cutting red tape by putting a deadline on municipalities. If they don't approve a permit in a set amount of time, the contractor can get external engineers to give them an evaluation, turn that in, and go forward.
Huh.
So So there's a lot of places in the state where they like would rather you didn't build, but there's no law against it. So like, yeah, give me your permit application. We'll get to it.
This sounds like a lot of common sense stuff so far.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is. There's some controversy. There's some parking reform. They're going to eliminate some of the parking mandates, which I also think is common sense as people become more transit oriented. We hope that they do. And if it helps them do so, that's a good byproduct. There's a statewide rule about ADUs, accessory dwelling units, the granny flats, coach houses, that doesn't change things in Chicago proper because we already have that. But in a lot of the suburbs with single family homes, there's some agita about the idea that your neighbor's going to put a house in the backyard and have some rental family they don't know move in. You know, there's a thing like that in single family areas. But the real controversial point is what they call automatic upzoning. That is, it says that anywhere in the state, you could build up to eight flat, a building of up to eight units, regardless of how it's currently zoned. So it kind of does away with single family zoning. And it is got suburban areas up in arms, the peaceful blocks that we have without riffraff in apartment buildings or however they state it, is objectionable. It's also a bit of a controversy, interestingly, in Logan Square, where they have their own ordinance that governs their community specifically that is aimed at preventing teardowns, which people are tearing down two flats, four flats there and building single family homes, which are more lucrative on the current housing market. One of those problems that we're having is how single family homes have become so outrageously expensive. So they're trying to encourage multi-units and discourage tearing those. So it's a little bit of a reverse, and yet it makes them kind of strange bedfellows with the you know, Barrington Hills that, you know, doesn't want anything other than single family homes. So statewide, there's quite a bit of concern about that. And I hear some rumors that it will ultimately, before it passes, if it passes, come down from eight flat to maybe six or even four. But we need more housing at all levels. Affordable housing, middle. There's the phrase that they use for this particular clause, the missing middle, where there are luxury homes and there are, in some communities, but not enough, of lower income homes.
Yeah.
This bill is aimed at the middle.
We could go through the nuances of the parking and the other thing. The idea that the state, though, top down, could say, I don't care what your zoning is, you got to have an eight flat or a six flat or even a four flat where there used to be a single family home, is going to get the NIMBYs upset. But I think even a lot of us that don't want to call ourselves NIMBYs getting upset about this. Kate, you want an eight flat right next to you?
No. Now, I live in a six flat. I live in an entire block of six flats. Most of my neighborhood is multi-unit buildings.
Oh.
I have no problem with that.
Cool.
Of course, if I could afford a single family home in my neighborhood, I'd probably get one. But anyway, I'm obviously not against multi-unit housing. But the way this legislation is starting out, it's actually even a little bit worse than when you get into the details than Marge, than I think people may realize from your explanation, because any lot over 2,500 square feet gets multiple housing, multiple units by right. Now, a typical Chicago lot is 3,125 feet. So like my grandparents' house in Hegwisch, 1,200 square feet house, was on that size lot. And we had just enough room for a tiny front yard, just enough room for a spot for the car to come in from the alley, and room in between for my grandma to have some flowers and grandpa to have some tomato plants. It's not a big lot. That's 3,125 feet. And now they're saying anything over 2,500 feet, that's a very small, you know, footprint. That would go up to four units.
Right.
Then if you've got 5,000, over 5,000 square feet, now you're looking at six units. Now, my family's bungalow was on a 5,000 square foot footprint. And that's because we were on the corner, so we got a little bit of an extra side yard. You know what? Yeah, my, you know, a multi-unit building can go there, but should it? That should be up to, in my opinion, local communities. I understand the whole abundance and, you know, progressive agenda to have multi-unit housing as much as possible because that's more affordable. That's all great. But I do not understand the impulse to take away democratic rights at a local level.
Well, they're going to say yes, that we all believe that wouldn't it be great for less housing, but village after village after village is denying the opportunity for multi-dwelling units where single family homes are going down, because they're saying, well, we love that idea, but how about Westmont does that instead? How about this town does it instead? And in full disclosure, my husband's on the zoning commission in Downers Grove and just joined it and is starting to get privy into this conversation. Zorn, are you flying your NIMBY flag here?
I think I am flying it a bit. I am really in favor of these ADUs, the granny flats, the idea that you could turn your garage or you could build an accessory dwelling unit in your basement so you could have more than one family living in what's now a single family home. We have that in our neighborhood here on the Northwest Side. We have a lot of two flats on our street, or there's some anyway, and then there's an apartment building not too far away either. I mean, I worry about the density, if you allow for four flats, and I'm not exactly sure how large our lot is. We've lived here 36 years, and I'm really impressed with Kate knowing the square footage of her former lots.
Probably have a normal lot.
Standard, we do, 25 by 125.
Probably something like that. Lot. Anyway, yeah, it's like that. And so I would worry about someone putting a four flat into our house, you know, because I can imagine someone coming in and buying up as many houses as they can on the block and putting up four flats, and suddenly you've got a very different neighborhood in terms of its density and parking and everything else. So I'd be in favor of like allowing single family homes to be double family homes, something like that, to expand housing opportunities. But some of these things that they're talking about seem like it would really change the character of the neighborhood in terms of just the number of people you'd have in it and the parking spaces that you would lose and everything else. So I'm in the middle there, but I think some of my NIMBY flag is flying.
Marge, do you think that some of this is being proposed as kind of like, this is the pie in the sky idea, then the reality of governance is going to kick in, and maybe you don't get the whole pie, but because you've gone as far as eight dwelling units, that they know they'll be compromised, but at least you're going to move the needle a little bit with whatever finally is able to pass in the House and the Senate. Do you think that's part of the play here?
Oh, I think so. And I just think that the mindset that we have toward the character of a neighborhood or the density of a neighborhood needs to catch up with the reality of the world we're in. According to a University of Illinois report, Illinois is right now short 142,000 homes. And in the next 5 years, they project we're going to need 227,000 new homes. I didn't as quickly get my fingers on the stats about home prices, but 10 years ago or so, I'm remembering what I read, average house was about 50% of average income, and then it went to 5 times and is projected to be 10 times and moving the way inflation's happening, of annual income. When I bought my first house, I was told, figure about a third of your income goes into housing. Well, that's not what's happening with people. Rent is doubling as fast as you could say it out loud. So I think about where I grew up. I grew up in an exurb of Detroit on 5 acres with woods and all this. And now those 5 acres are a 55-plus community that houses I don't know how many families. I hate driving by there. It makes me sad to see it, but I understand. People need housing. I live in a high-rise with 220 units, and I just think community living is the direction we're going in, and you have to do it at state level because it isn't going to happen locally. Those mayors aren't going to upzone. There's not going to happen. I wish they would look at a building code, statewide building code, so we could say, get copper pipes out of houses and PVC like they do in other places, and then the cost of building in Chicago will be a lot cheaper. The stair rule takes down the price of a house and allows more footage and more units in the same footprint. So these are things addressed at the new reality.
Yeah.
And we are seeing climate migrants as well as More, we're going to have a new wave of migration from the South coming up north, I predict, if the trends, political trends continue. And character of a community is code words for fighting what other people need, I think.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a compromise somewhere where it's not necessarily a dwelling unit. Every lot can be converted if they make mandates for municipalities. X percent of certain rezoning decisions have to allow for X, Y, or Z. Maybe there's a more gradual way that still allows some local control where they can pick and choose where maybe it works or where it doesn't. But they're at least mandated to require some amount of them to say yes. They can't say no to all of them. They've got to pick and choose some areas. And maybe that's the way to move the needle a little bit on this. This is a meaty topic. We could go on forever and ever. But there's yet another meaty topic coming down the road. And that is the fact that President Trump, for everything we could all say about the president, has an iron grip on his party that has been tested and everyone thinks that they're going to turn the page and has not. Bill Cassidy got third place in a Louisiana primary. He voted, of course, to impeach the president after the 2020 insurrection. Thomas Massie got pretty walloped, pretty good, in his race in the Kentucky 4th Congressional District. I don't think there's ever been a politician who, when they put their endorsement name on it, it works so well, at least in a primary. And that's what we see here. I don't know if that translates to the general. He's not a popular president right now. But for some people, it boggles the mind every time. And I don't know when people are going to learn that until proven otherwise, Republicans, whether Trump is still the president or not, are going to consider themselves Trump Republicans. And everyone's got to get used to the fact that until it's proven otherwise, we're going to hear the name Trump Republican for 30 years because of how much power he has over the party.
30 years? That makes Trump 110 years old.
I don't think, I mean, but Eric, there's Reagan Republicans still, right? Maybe not as many as there were
not
10 years ago.
Not very many.
But
I don't know.
I just mean that his endorsement and his philosophy and his policies are so popular with the Republican Party that he has established himself as the kingmaker. Well, this will impact the 2028 election, I think.
No question. He's a kingmaker. I do not know what his philosophies are that are appealing to the Republican Party. I mean, his personality, his charisma, his manner is certainly appealing to people. But, you know, some of the policies that he articulates, he promised he wasn't going to get us into wars. And now we're in this, looks like a quagmire in Iran. He promised to bring down prices, and it looks like prices are still going up. And all the things that he promises to clean out the swamp, and there's been no more swampy administration than the Trump regime that we've seen. So I can't articulate what it is that they like about him. I mean, he brutalizes immigrants, and they like that. And he cuts taxes for the rich. I guess they like that. But I don't know what exactly you'd say this is a Trump philosophy. This is what MAGA means. He has said himself, MAGA is who he is. Now, these election results in Indiana, we talked about that, where he, five out of seven state senators who crossed him in this redistricting battle lost their seats after his endorsement. He and AIPAC dumped millions and millions of dollars into this in the Republican primary in Kentucky. And, he was able to generate a lot of power. But my theory about this is that this is going to backfire on them, that he is basically boiling his party down into this hardcore MAGA cult. And that cult, that party, that Republican brand is not very popular. His poll numbers are poor. And the party is looking more and more extreme. And to win the congressional elections this fall and to win the presidency in 2028, you've got to appeal to independent and moderate voters who maybe gave Trump a chance, who were really turned off by Biden and Kamala Harris, but are really turned off by the way Trump has handled a lot of issues. So I don't think this is – it's obviously clearly a sign, as you point out, that he has control over this party. But I don't think that control is going to pay off for them in the fall.
But will it ever loosen? Marge, do you see a pivot after, let's say, the Republicans lose the midterms? Do you see them then cutting ties with the president? I don't. I think they're still looking for their endorsements in their primaries in 2028 while he's gearing up for helping the next Republican president, in theory.
I've thought from the beginning it will only change when they fear the voters more than they fear Trump, and apparently they're not there yet. You know, it's a cult. Eric, the only way to explain it. He's had that same, you know, upper 30%, 37, 39, you know, percent of the American people behind him, no matter what he does, all along. And that has not changed. I think about, you know, there are those guys who, for comedic effect, I guess, or to amuse those of us in the blue bubble, they interview Trump fans. And I saw a reel a while ago of a guy who said, you know, Trump 2028, you'd vote for Trump for a third term? Oh, absolutely. I think he's great. You know, what do you like what he's doing? Well, he's keeping his promises. He's doing everything he said he's going to do. And the interviewer says, well, like what? Given what you just said, Eric, those who know the facts know he's certainly not doing anything he promised, really, except enriching himself. And the answer was, well, you know, just all the things he does. He promised and he's doing them. Can you name one? The things, you know, that he promised. Like, that's a cult. That's somebody who drank the Kool-Aid. They're catatonic. They're Stepford wives. I don't know what to call them, but they're not thinking, and you're not going to rationally get to them. But they are not a majority of the voters. And the voters are angry, and there'll be a Trump backlash. We just need voters to, like, maybe we in the Democratic Party need better, more favorable polling for our Democratic Party as well.
But can't you envision, though, like even in 15 years, if the president is still alive, out of office in his 90s, his dad, I think, and his mom live very long lives. I mean, I could still see him as a kingmaker endorsing candidates for primaries because people, I mean, you call it a cult, Marge. I don't know if I agree with that, but there's cult-like tendencies among some of his voters, I'll say. But I think that a lot of them do just like him, regardless of what the policies are. And you might call that a cult. You might just say, hey, I trust this guy. I voted for him. I guess what I'm ultimately getting at, if you call them a cult, Marge, how do you break that? Like, I don't think there's ever a break from that. So there's going to be 20 years of this.
Obviously, his main cult followers, they're not going to break from him unless they all go drink Kool-Aid, right? So fine, you've got a certain faction that are never going to break from him, including if he lives another 15 years, as you hypothesize, in a very scary way. But so the question is, though, the normie Republicans, people who have voted Republican, that faction of people who can be swayed, are they going to be supporting Trump's Republicans, Trump's, the people he got to win primaries? Will they be supporting them in the general election? We don't know, because of course in primaries, it's always the extreme of each party that is, you know, in there electing the primary people. Mm-hmm. So if these MAGA people are mostly up against, you know, more moderate Democrats, it could very well play against them. Now, you know, it's not like I've analyzed every one of these races. Perhaps they're all going to be up against the most extreme leftist Democrat Socialist of America candidates. And then that will be very interesting to see. But I think that's what the question is. So Trump is not necessarily always going to be a kingmaker. I do think once, you know, if and when his MAGA people start losing at the polls, then that will break the spell. The question is, when is that going to happen?
Eric, I have a question for you. It's a weird one. Are you jealous that the Democrats don't have a voice that could sway a populace in a way? I can't imagine Joe Biden an endorsement making an ounce of difference. Maybe that's not a bug. Maybe that's a feature. Obama has some power, but not really. Are you jealous that there's not like a Democrat that can be like, hey, we're doing this, people? Because I'm a little jealous and I'm admiring of the fact that this scenario exists in a major party in this country, that the president can say this and these people lose. Like, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah, I wish in some ways that the left had somebody who was like that, who was that influential. Obama, I don't think, ever had that kind of juice in local elections. Part of it was that people didn't want the big money. I mean, this Massey race in Kentucky was the most expensive congressional primary in history. Both sides spent a ton of money on it, and kind of absurd. I've thought about, you know, what if the left had a Trumpian figure. I'm trying to think who that might be. Michael Moore, maybe, or someone who is
there's no one there.
Oprah. There really is. I mean, that's Oprah. But you know, someone who is as rash and amoral and profane as Donald Trump, as such a narcissist and a grifter, is there? Would I want that? And I don't want that. I don't want people in politics who have that kind of sway over people. I want people to be much more policy oriented. I want indoor Republicans to come back home to their principles that they claim to adhere to for all these years, and suddenly they've abandoned them all. Interestingly enough, Cassidy in Louisiana, who changed his vote on the Iran war resolution after he lost, because he figured like, well, screw you, Trump. But he's been trying to stay in lockstep. All these guys have been trying to kiss up to Trump, and it doesn't work because the cult following is so strong.
I guess the point I'm making is, as we've talked about it in this show, about Democratic infighting between Johnson and Pritzker. Well, now is not the time for infighting. I agree with that. We talk about, I wish Democrats could get in a line. Sounds like the Democrats actually want a cult of their own, if that's what we're going to call it.
No, I don't think so. I mean, you sort of describing two different kinds of leadership. One is somebody like Obama that garners respect, but encourages, I think, and people to think for themselves, who doesn't want to dictate who to vote for, though he certainly endorses, and that does carry some weight. But when you describe this cult aspect, I don't think that's not a goal I would endorse for the Democratic Party. I don't think that gets us ahead. People need to think for themselves and understand policy the way Eric said. And the guy who thinks Trump is doing everything he promised ought to fill up his tank with gas today and see how much he thinks Trump has helped him. You know, there's a lot of how bad does it have to get before they realize? I think that 37% or whatever is never going to realize. But I think those who either stayed home instead of voting for Kamala Harris or Biden, or those who crossed over to give Trump a chance, thinking fondly of the great economy that he started with in his first term, which, of course, he inherited from a Democrat, which is how that goes historically, you know, maybe they'll think twice as the economy continues to tank, which is not the way either that I would like to achieve Democratic Party unity.
Let's approach the stoplights, red light, yellow light, and green light. For things we're watching, let's lighten things up. Eric first.
I want to recommend a sketch on Saturday Night Live from a couple weeks ago with Matt Damon and Sarah Sherman, where they both play auctioneers who are married and bickering with one another. It's exquisitely well acted, and I've got the link in the Picayune Sentinel tomorrow.
Oh, I like that. Where are we going next, Marge? Red light, yellow, green light.
I'm going to green light the new Timeline Theater building. It's an old theater company, but a new building that just opened up in Uptown last weekend. It's a beautiful building up on Broadway in Uptown. And their opening play in this space is Enemy of the People, the Ibsen play from the 1800s that rings true today. The basic theme is a doctor who finds there's a potential danger that will make the community sick. It's a longer story, but warns the populace that, you know, illness is coming. We have to do something about it, but it's tied to an investment and a tourist trap that they're building. And people turn on him because he tells the truth about, you know, not COVID-19, but another health risk. And he's ostracized for telling the truth and tries to stand by his principles anyway. So it rings true in a lot of ways, more ways than I would like to say, but it's beautifully acted, as Timeline always is. And it's a gorgeous space. So I greenlight it and urge people to check it out.
Love that. Kate?
Totally frivolous, fun stuff. As requested, I say consider watching Widow's Bay. It's a new show on Apple. I think it'll be the fifth episode is tonight. It stars Matthew Riss, who everyone will remember from The Americans. It's sort of supernatural. It's about this island that appears to be cursed, and the mayor, Matthew Riss, is kind of trying to turn it into a tourist attraction and having problems because of the various cursed aspects that keep popping up. I will say the first couple of episodes were really good, but I might have said, oh, it's a little too light. I might not bother with it tonight if there's something more dramatic. But you know what? We got to episode 4 last week, and we were just blown away at how they made a lot of different threads come together in a much more substantial way that I really can't get into, or I would give things away. It's really, really worth it.
All right. I'm going to give a yellow light, yellow green light to, oh, this is such a terrible show, but I really liked it. It's not terrible. It's called The Gilded Age. It was a very, it's about the Gilded Age, shocker, in New York. It's these drama families of trying to make it in the upper crust. It's not. It's Julian Fellowes who wrote Downton Abbey. If you want just to zone out a little bit, and if you happen to twiddle on your phone for 5 minutes and miss something, you haven't missed anything. It's okay. I can't even believe. We watched the first episode. I was like, "This is let's just start episode two." And we finished the entire series up to this point in about 2 weeks just because it's mindless and I enjoyed it. So if that absolutely doesn't appeal to you, that's a yellow light. If you're okay with a little of that in your life, that's a green light. Kate, Eric, and Marge, we may not agree on everything, but I always learn something. You guys make me think a lot harder about things and to defend my sides. And I appreciate you guys letting me fill in today. Thank you all.
Fun to have you here.
Great seeing you.
Hi.
Come back soon.
Fun time. Absolutely.
John will be back next week. John Williams. That'll do it for the Mincing Rascals. Thank you all so much for listening. Brett and Pete, thank you so much for your help behind the glass. And we'll chat with you soon.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.